Leading Edge Medicine provides only general medical information. Since everyone's individual situation is unique, you should consult your own physician before taking any action related to your personal health. All content of this program is intended for general informational purposes only. Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians, all while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you the opportunity to participate in the show. Now, here are your hosts for Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat, along with their co-host, Lynette Morgan.
Right. Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Lynette.
Yes, good morning. Here we are. I can't believe we're to the end of September. First day of fall is tomorrow.
Is it?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, wow. Good morning. I'm Lynette, along with Dr. Jerry Mixon, and we have a special guest doctor here today, Dr. Dan Nelson of Pro Ortho. We like to call him our pain doctor, right?
Mm.
So
that's right.
He's the one that if you're like, oh, if I move this way, it hurts. I hurt my knee. Should I get a hip replacement? My back's sore. What can I do? Dr. Nelson and his staff are the ones that can really help you. So he is our special guest. And let me give that phone number out right now, and we will dive right into our show. Here's that number. It's 1-800-465-8770. That is 1-800-465-8770. And we are Leading Edge Medicine. So give us a call. All right. So Dr. Mixon.
Yes.
What is going on in medical news? What is new?
Well, you know, we did have kind of an interesting paper this past week. Type 2 diabetes is rampant in America.
Right.
The Center for Disease Control now predicts that one American in three will be diabetic before they die, which is kind of frightening because in the 1930s, it was one American in 147.
Yikes.
So,
wow.
You know.
That's a big difference.
Our genome has not changed. What's changed is our diet and our lifestyle. We are sedentary. We are much less active than we were in the 1930s.
Right.
You know, when everything was walking or bicycles and, you know, and our food portions were much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And so the majority of people over 50 are now pre-diabetic when you check the hemoglobin A1C. An A1C of 5.7 is pre-diabetic, and a 6.5 you are an overt diabetic. So pre-diabetes is the majority of people over 50 now. And overt diabetes in about one in three at some point in their life, which is just horrendous.
Right.
Our risk has always been pretty much weight. For Caucasians and African ancestry, those two groups, being overweight to obese has always been the primary driver. And the reason I specified those two racial groups, Asians, especially Han Chinese and Northern India, become diabetic even if they are slender. So that they have a genetic predisposition for diabetes. So they need to stay physically active and lean, not just not fat. They actually need a lot of extra muscle mass to maintain, to burn the sugar, to maintain their healthy metabolism. But now there's a paper just came out of Harvard showing that even for people who are just a little bit overweight but not obese, who eat too much in the way of beef, pork, and chicken, that is our traditional meats, have a 26% higher risk of diabetes than people who have a primarily plant-based diet.
Wow. Mm, interesting.
And, you know, and it's not, it doesn't say you have to be a vegetarian, but it turns out that the highest quintile, the top 20% of meat consumption results in a 26% increased risk of diabetes, even if you're just a little bit overweight.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Huh.
So worrisome.
Right.
So that is a sign to say, A, don't get even a little bit overweight.
Right.
You know,
right.
Get your weight down in the bottom half of the normal range, not in the top half. And, you know, you don't have to give up meats, but don't be real heavy on your meats. You don't go out on a regular basis and buy that great big 30-ounce steak and stuff it all
the
down.
Tomahawk.
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
So,
that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So you buy that $70 6-ounce filet instead.
Right, right. Huh, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
And because people have traditionally, well, including medical people in the past, have associated diabetes and type 2, maybe too many carbohydrates in their diet and everything. But this is really goes in the face of that, and it's meat products. And
well, they think it's the getting the iron from hemoglobin.
Ah,
it's the hemoglobin, the iron, the blood in those animals that seems to be the trigger.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, the hemoglobin. Okay.
Yeah. So it's the high hemoglobin meats, and the more of the high hemoglobin meats you bring in. It seemed to do it.
Interesting.
So once more, perhaps the kosher from both Jewish and Islamic tradition in which the animals are thoroughly bled before they're slaughtered.
Oh, right, right.
You know, might have a benefit. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think that particular variation has been studied.
Yeah,
so observant Jews and Muslims might or might not fall subject to this.
Right. No, that's a kosher or halal and the Muslim.
That's right. Halal and kosher.
Yeah. And that's fascinating. So, and those two groups you mentioned, Northern India and I think maybe
Han Chinese.
Han Chinese. There's also the issue with visceral fat versus regular, subcutaneous fat that most of us or people in general worry about, the subcutaneous, because that's what shows up. But visceral fat turns out to be a real problem.
Yeah, that's the biggest inflammatory trigger we've got in our systems, is the amount of fat we have around our organs. It's not the fat on your butt that kills you, it's the fat inside your belly.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Which is harder to deal with, because you can't really exercise that.
You do.
Oh,
that's the fascinating thing. There was a study 2 weeks ago, which I wasn't going to bring up today, but it ticked it in my memory. overweight and obese people who exercise regularly. You see out when I got on the trail, there are some people I see that are really heavy. I mean, these people are 100 pounds overweight, but they're out there on the trail doing their damnedest.
Yeah.
You know, their run is a very slow jog, but they're doing it.
And I always admire those people when I see them. I think, good for you.
Absolutely. But it turns out that they actually reduce the visceral fat. Now, they stay overweight, but they shift the fat to sub-Q.
Okay.
So they decrease the visceral fat and move it out under the skin where it shows, but it's actually less dangerous. So
interesting.
So there's
some flux involved where you can shift the visceral fat,
so
to speak.
And so muscular activity, working muscle, actually decreases visceral fat.
Right.
And so you got to remember, working muscle is a very active gland, and it kicks out over 600 different enzymes, peptides, proteins,
myokines,
and growth factors.
All that stuff.
And all those myokines alter our metabolism, and it actually decreases visceral fat, even if you're obese.
Right, right.
Which is really kind of neat.
Wow.
And, it goes back to the saying I've heard a long time ago, and I'm Dr. Mixon, I'm sure, has heard this, that the most important thing we can prescribe as physicians would be exercise.
Yes.
All the other scripts we write for medications and stuff, exercise by far is the best thing.
You know, it increases survival from cancer dramatically. Vigorous exercise, men with prostate cancer who take up a vigorous exercise program improve their survival by 40%.
Right.
Women with breast cancer who take up vigorous exercise improve their survival by 60%.
Right. And, of course, there's all the cognitive benefits of exercise that
increases blood flow to the brain, decreases inflammation throughout your system.
Probably some neurotrophic benefits from...
Well, again, working muscle triggers brain-derived neurotrophic factors that actually help you to grow new brain cells.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, those working muscles are important. So the more muscle you got, the more vigorously and frequently it is exercised, the more myokines and growth factors you kick out.
And that's what I always tell my patients. One of the main job, my main jobs is to keep you moving.
Yes.
You know, because once you stop moving, bad things happen in general.
Yes. Sedentary is the new smoking.
Right. Oh. Yeah. Right. Yes.
So. All right. Anyway, that's our catch up for the morning.
I love it.
That is
That's a good one.
Yes, yeah. and so many people don't find out that they are even diabetic until they're there. Their numbers are already there. Doctors tend not to let you know, okay, you're getting close to being pre-diabetic, you know, so that you know all of a sudden, you're there, and
Yeah, it's kind of pathetic when someone shows up in the emergency room with a blood sugar over 300 and they had no idea they were diabetic because for some reason their primary care physician never told them. It just kind of boggles my mind. It's like the old thing that somehow doctors used to be afraid to give bad news. And people would get cancer. And the question was, do we tell them or not? Why should we tell them and spoil their life? Of course, that was back in the days when there was nothing you could do.
Right.
You know, you had cancer and you just made a guesstimate as how long they had to live.
Right.
Yeah. Now we get very aggressive with our therapies. And so, but you can't put somebody on radiation and chemotherapy or surgery unless
they have some consent.
They got to know why you're doing all this stuff.
Sign here.
Yeah.
Initial here. Yes.
Yeah.
Very important.
All right. Somebody out there better give us a call this morning.
Okay. Well, let's get these phones ringing. I'm Lynette along with Dr. Jerry Mixon today. Dr. UMAT is off this weekend.
She is indeed.
Yes. And we'll find out all about her adventure when she gets back. Dr. Dan Nelson from Pro Ortho is here with us. And if you have questions about, what we open the show with, diabetes, obesity, some of those things, can diabetes be reversed? And Dr. Mixon says,
Absolutely. In 70% of the people.
There you go.
That's type 2, not type 1. But yes, about 7 out of 10 people with type 2 diabetes have the potential to turn it around.
All right.
There's that other 30% that have basically totally burned out their pancreas. There's not a whole lot we can do for them.
Mm-hmm.
But 7 out of 10 are early enough. And we've actually reversed it in people who were diabetic for 30 years, though. So.
Wow.
The length of time doesn't necessarily correlate.
Interesting.
It's how much pancreatic function you got left.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to go to a break right now. I'm Lynette. We'll be back with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Dan Nelson. Your questions for the doctors. Next, phone lines are open for you. Here is that number to call in. It's 1-800-465-8770. That's 1-800-465-8770. This is Leading Edge Medicine. We will be back with Jan from Kirkland in just a moment. Stay right there. We're back with Leading Edge Medicine. I'm not the dancing queen. Dr. Samira UMAT is. And she's not in the studio
right
now.
She's shaking her bangles and she does just fine.
Absolutely. I'm Lynette here with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Dan Nelson, Leading Edge Medicine today, live in the studio. And here is the number to get into the call queue, like so many have already done. Wow. 1-800-465-8770. We're going to take our first call from Kirkland. We have Jan on the line. Good morning, Jan.
Good morning. I am wondering if you have CKD stage 3, what should be the maximum amount of protein, potassium, oxalic acid, and phosphorus you should have in a day?
I don't know.
Yeah.
this depends on the This is why we have nephrologists.
Right.
These are doctors who do nothing but treat kidney disease, both acute and chronic. And we know, as a general rule, you need less protein, less potassium, less sodium, and less fluid, because the kidneys are not as good at filtering and adjusting the homeostasis in our body. But basically, the kidney's job is to take all this stuff we throw in our mouth and that our gut absorbs and measures the amount that is right in our bloodstream and kicks out the excess and conserves if we don't have enough. And so the kidneys are kind of a regulatory mechanism. They hold on to things you don't have enough of, and they excrete things you have too much of. When your kidneys start getting sick, we start losing that regulatory mechanism. And so now we have to start paying attention to what goes in our mouth, because not the kidneys are not as able to do the adjusting for us. So we kind of have to give them a hand. And so the nephrologist is the one who is looking at this particular individual and says, okay, this person, I'm following them, I'm measuring, they're telling me about their diet, and we're seeing what the effects are. And so he has, part of his job is to help that individual adjust their personal diet, their personal intake, for what their kidney function is right now.
Right.
And chronic kidney disease tends to get worse over time. And so the nephrologist has to continue monitoring whatever he tells them at one point in their life will not be accurate a year or two later. And so for me to try to give rules on the radio to thousands of people out there with chronic kidney disease, none of whom I have measured their blood and electrolyte status, would be... professionally suicidal, because I'd only get sued about 900 times a year.
Yeah, we don't want that.
We aren't going there. I can give you the general rules. I can't tell you how much each individual should be taking.
Yeah. Right, and the nephrologist will be looking at things like GFR, creatinine. Sometimes they'll do something called a 24-hour year. I mean, they can't even give the patients good advice without measuring those
precisely
things, right?
And that's his job. Is the nephrologist is looking at this patient on an ongoing basis and adjusting their diet to help compensate for their failing kidneys.
Yeah. Well, my primary physician said that she wasn't going to refer me because there wasn't anything much more at this stage, anything much more they could do than what's, you know, she could do.
Yeah, well, then she should, I mean, if that's her attitude, then she should be competent, or believe she's competent, to give you the guidance you're asking me. That, you know, because she's the one seeing your lab work, and she's seeing your electrolyte studies, and then she should be telling you, you know, limit your sodium to this, your potassium to that, your protein to this other thing. And if she isn't competent to do that, because I can assure you I'm not, she should be referring you to the nephrologist to do it for her.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. Well, what would you said you could give some very general things? The thing is, back on my protein quite a bit, mm-hmm. and I'm finding I do not have the energy on my walks that I normally do.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, I'm.
The question is that due to the kidney disease or because you're shorting yourself on protein?
I think it's shortening myself on protein. I've had kidney disease probably for 20, 25 years.
All right.
And it took a worse downhill thing once I started on my astaxanthin for my eyes.
Sure.
And I'm one of the very few that the shots in my eyes affect my kidneys.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Well, you know, general rules of thumb, okay? A healthy, sedentary person with older person with kind of marginal but still low normal kidney function, you're looking at about a gram of protein per pound of lean body mass, not of total body weight, of lean body mass. Okay, yeah. So you have to subtract fat mass from that, and that means you know
right.
how much of you is fat and how much of you is muscle.
Yeah.
People that are exercising heavily and trying to make muscle and stay really fit need to go up to as much as 2 grams per pound.
Okay. Oh.
And so there's 1 to 2 grams per pound, depending on how much stress you're putting on your muscles. And it sounds yeah. just from what you're reporting to me that one possibility is you may be overdoing the restriction because you don't have the muscular strength that you need. So,
right.
But, you know, if you were my patient, I'd be asking for help from the nephrologist. You know, I've gone 48 years of medicine without a malpractice suit. And it's not because I haven't had bad results. I have. I'm a mortal human being, and I've made mistakes in my life. But, you know, I try to develop a relationship with the patient, and if I make a boo-boo, I admit my boo-boos, and I don't charge the patient to fix it.
You know, right.
And people for the last 48 years have been very understanding that I don't claim that my MD stands for minor deity, you know, that it stands for, you know, my wife says occasionally mentally deficient.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, what would be general on potassium? The thing is, many of the foods which are low in protein are high in potassium.
High in potassium. Yeah, that's right. And again, once more, in older people, many of us are on medications that either conserve potassium or waste potassium. Mm-hmm. So yeah. if you're on something like a thiazide diuretic to get rid
no.
of the excess fluid,
yeah.
then you have to take extra potassium.
You yeah. know,
if you're on some other medications that actually conserve, some of the blood pressure medicines actually hold potassium in your system, then you need to cut it down lower. So once more, it's a matter of going through your entire medical history, look at all your medications, and look up which ones conserve, which ones waste, and you know which ones are neutral. And
yeah,
then
I'm basically
measure,
on.
Yeah, and then we measure the potassium in your bloodstream and say, oh, you're right in the middle of the range, or you're at the high end, let's cut it down a bit, or you're at the low end, let's boost it up a bit. And once more, without having access to your lab work, it would be foolish to start trying to give advice because I don't have the information I need.
Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe it would be helpful to get a phone consult with Dr. Yu, Matt, and she might be able to give me some yes. more stuff because I don't see her till early, yeah, till into November.
If you're her patient, because unlike here at the radio show, I'm just in the
yeah.
studio. And
right.
I don't have access to your medical records, but she's got access to your records. So
yeah.
she can pull
right.
up your potassium, pull up your sodium, look at your GFR, and she can start giving you some better advice than I can sitting here with no information at all about your health history.
Okay.
All right.
Well, since I don't see her for 6-8 weeks, I'll...
Just call the staff and get a phone call. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, one of
right.
the advantages of being a patient at Longevity is we don't limit the number of visits.
Yes,
you
right.
know, you're one of our people. She'll work you in. She'll find a chance to chat with you on the phone as often as you need to.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I shall do that then.
All right. Thank you for the call, my dear.
Okay, fine. Thank you,
Jan.
Okay. Bye.
All right. This is Leading Edge Medicine. Here is the number to get through, just like Jan did, 1-800-465-8770. We're headed to Gig Harbor. We have Rob on the line. Welcome to Leading Edge Medicine, Rob. Good morning.
Good morning, Rob.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm taking Eliquis morning and night because I occasionally have episodes of AFib, very occasionally, and no symptoms whatsoever. But mm-hmm. Dr. Jimenez said I can't do senescent cell therapy if I'm on a blood thinner. And so I'd like to do senescent cell therapy. Now, when I go in for a colonoscopy next month, they're going to give me a little Eliquis holiday. I stopped taking it 2 days before I have the colonoscopy and start again maybe the next couple of days. Can I take an Eliquis vacation, do the senescent cell therapy? Would that be okay?
There are no guidelines on this. You know, the dasatinib, if you were somebody with a chronic myelogenous leukemia, which is the reason that most people are on dasatinib, they're on it every day, 100 milligrams a day, every day of their lives for years at a time. And they are told, don't take blood thinners because they interact with the dasatinib and you can actually trigger a bleeding episode. Now, when we use it for senescent cell therapy, we're only using it for 3 days at a time, not for months and years at a time. And so the risk should go way down. The problem is that when the studies were done on senescent cell therapy, when Mayo Clinic was doing the studies, they excluded people that were on blood thinners. So we have no data.
No data.
Because when they did their studies, they didn't let anybody in the study that was already on a blood thinner.
Right.
And so anything we did with that would be a sheer guess. You know, I mean, and if I were guessing, I would guess that, yeah, if you stopped it 2 days before you took your stuff for 3 days and then you went back on it for the next four, you know, for 2 days and stopped it before the next 3 day course, probably, probably, but we don't really know. It's a guess.
So
you understand Dr. Jimenez's position. She doesn't like taking guesses with your life.
Yeah. I don't mind. I'm kind of like you. I don't mind making a guess now and then and, you know, pushing the envelope a little bit.
Right. Well, and you know what could be done, and once more, this is betwixt you and Dr. Jimenez to some degree. You know, if you said, yes, look, I really, really want to do this, and I don't think I'm at much risk, and you sign releases saying that, you know, if you stop taking it and then you throw a stroke, that your relatives don't get to sue her. All right.
Yeah. I get That's it. Okay. I understand.
We just don't
have a second question, Jerry. Second question.
Hang on, though. We got to take a break. You hear the music. We'll be back in about a minute or two, so you hold on.
All right. Rob, you hang on the line, and we will be right back with your question. Howard, Bill, Robert, we'll get to you as well. Here's that number to call for Leading Edge Medicine today, 1-800-465-8770. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
Feel like a woman.
You know, to be politically correct, this, should be, this song should be sung with someone with a big, deep bass voice.
Yeah. No, Shania is doing it, but she's too much of a girl.
I feel like a woman.
Yeah. Hey, we're back. It's Leading Edge Medicine. I'm Lynette here with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Dan Nelson from Pro Ortho. Here's that number to get through and get into the call queue today. It's 1-800-465-8770, and we have Rob on the line talking with the doctors.
Thank you, Rob. My second question is, prior to developing AFib about 2 months ago, I was taking 3 grams of fish oil every day for the last 5 years or longer, and I would bruise like crazy.
Yes.
I mean, I'd really bruise very easily. So as soon as I developed the AFib, so as soon as I developed the AFib, my doctor said, hey, let's put you on Eliquis, and I Googled it, and it said, if you're on Eliquis, you might not want to take fish oil too. So I immediately stopped taking the fish oil, went on the Eliquis, and I've been on the Eliquis for about 2 months now. I don't bruise at all, nothing. So which is the better anticoagulant, fish oil or Eliquis?
All right. Well, two different things. First of all, 3 grams of fish oil a day, you're bumping up right up against the very highest limit that the FDA approves. All right, because at that level, you get a significant anticoagulation effect, and you probably raise your triglycerides too. So generally, 3 grams a day, we tell people don't exceed that. In fact, you're already right up at the upper edge of what is tolerable. And some people don't tolerate it. Now, the reality is, good Lord made us according to a single general plan, but there are significant individual variations on that plan. Mm-hmm. And for most people, 3 grams is the upper edge. For you, you may be a bit over that edge. And certainly the combination of 3 grams of omega-3s in addition to Eliquis could put you into a real bleeding bind. So I would not take that much of the two. But again, given your history, the omega-3s instead of the Eliquis would probably function quite well.
Right.
But once more,
that's what I'm thinking. And Eliquis is $500 a month.
Yeah, and omega-3s are dirt cheap. Yes.
Right.
You know, but once more, we're in a situation in which it makes good sense, but we don't have peer-reviewed studies in which they have compared clotting factors in 10,000 people, 5,000 on Eliquis and 5,000 on fish oils at various doses to give us an equivalence. And so once more, this is that part of that vast amount of knowledge that we doctors just don't have. Right. You know, I spend my life reading medical journal articles. I spend about 5 hours every single day of my life reading articles. And I got to tell you, I read an article, I get one answer, and I get three more questions. I am constantly appalled at how little I really know about the human body and how to help it function better. And despite the fact that I spend most of my life trying to figure it out, there's just so much I don't know. You know, we just haven't done all the studies. That's all there is to it.
And I might point out, though, that comparing Eliquis to fish oil, nobody's going to study fish oil and spend $200 million on a study, right?
No.
I mean, that's not going to happen. The economics aren't there.
Right.
Eliquis is a blockbuster drug.
Sure, and they get their money back.
And they get their money back.
And they make a really nice profit.
Right. So we have, so that kind of becomes, you know, the standard of care because the, and not to paint a broad brush against the pharmaceutical industry, but they kind of call the shots,
They do. Well, and you have to realize that America has more attorneys than the rest of the world put together.
Right.
And physicians, doctors, we kind of conceptualize ourselves as a herd of herbivores on the plain, just grazing along on the grass, but we're being circled by predators with law degrees.
Right.
And everybody's afraid to get out on the edge of the herd where they might get eaten. And so everyone wants to do what everyone else is doing because if you stay in the middle of the herd, the predators don't get you.
Right. Okay?
And so when you start asking these questions, can I use omega-3s instead of Eliquis to do my dasatinib therapy? We have to sit there and shudder because we see ourselves moving right out on the edge where the predators might pick us off.
Right. I can just see the deposition. Doctor, so you can you quote studies on fish oil comparing to Eliquis for Eliquis? I mean, it just
did you tell this guy to do that?
Yes.
No. And there is no way to defend yourself in court. And so the doctors say no. On the other hand, we have studies that show that treating you with a dasatinib and quercetin for 9 days is going to lower your senescent cells by about 70%. And make your brain and your heart and your lungs and your kidneys and your bones and your immune system all function better, probably extend your lifespan and make you a healthier human being. But on the downside, if you happen to have go into atrial fib and flip off a clot and get hurt, your doctor and the clinic could be destroyed.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep, I get it.
What the hell do we do?
Hey. I appreciate your guys' perspective as always.
So,
thank you.
All right, we'll do our best within the society in which we function.
That's right.
Yes. Yes.
Thanks again, guys.
Thank you for the call.
All right. Thank you for the call, sir.
Bye. All right.
Okay, we are now headed over to talk with Howard. Howard is calling from Burien. Good morning, Howard.
Good morning. How's everybody?
Good.
We're doing pretty good.
Good. Potassium supplements. My blood pressure has been a little high lately. I was going to increase potassium. My blood level is about 4 to 4.5, which I guess is normal.
Yeah.
And I noticed supplements are limited to only 99 milligrams.
Yeah.
So what's the story behind that? Because the minimum requirement, you know, is up in the thousands.
Okay. Well, let me give you a graphic example. Right?
Good.
When they decide to execute someone with a lethal injection, what they inject them with is potassium. It stops their heart and they die. All right. Potassium is a muscle relaxer and it does lower blood pressure. It lowers blood pressure by relaxing those muscles in the wall of the arteries because we have smooth muscle and arteries are a dynamic structure. That muscle relaxes and opens up the artery and blood pressure goes down and blood flows more easily. Or the artery contracts and you're trying to pump the same amount of blood through a smaller tube. And so it takes more pressure to pump the same amount of blood through a smaller tube. So pressure goes up. Okay. So potassium relaxes those muscles in your arterial walls, lowers your blood pressure, gives you better blood flow. But if you overdo it, muscles relax too much. Blood pressure drops too low. You stand up and fall on your nose. And if you happen to be on a street corner and fall in front of another car or on the stairs and fall down the stairs and break your neck, then your potassium killed you. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the dose we give to the for lethal injections is really big. It's way, way, way more than you're going to absorb orally from your potassium pills. You'd have to take the whole darn bottle to get that magnitude of effect. But that's why they limit it. Because they don't want your potassium to go too high and drop your blood pressure out too low.
Okay, so if my potassium's in the normal recommended range, wouldn't help me to take more, I guess. However,
probably.
Do you agree with the government recommended levels of blood?
Well, I know that those are safe levels. Okay, and you know, once more, as I explained before, we are sitting here on the radio without access to your labs. We aren't taking your blood pressures. We're not following you along. You know, I don't have a doctor-patient relationship. We're just the guy on the radio giving general advice. Remember the disclaimer at the beginning of the show? Check with your own physician.
Yes, I do.
You know, okay.
I've been listening for years.
Wonderful.
You know, so reality, most of the time, people will get diarrhea and low blood pressure long before they really get hurt with excess potassium. But that's most of the time.
Okay. And could I ask you real quick about nitric oxide? Do we talk about quite a bit?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I, you know, tried the supplement, both the powder and the chewies. And when I work out or go for a run or whatever, I don't notice any change on the days I take that or don't take it. And I just wonder, how long does that take to actually affect, you know, from the time you take, say, the supplement until you work out, how long does it take to get in the bloodstream to do you any good? How long does it last?
Yeah, the chewies work within 5 or 10 minutes, usually, because it's actually in the saliva and you swallow. You actually produce the nitric oxide in your mouth and swallow it in your stomach and absorb it from the stomach. You know, so it depends on what the dose you're taking and how much nitric oxide you are already producing. General rule, when you're in your early 60s, you're only producing about 6 or 7% of this nitric oxide you produced when you were 15 or so. So as a kid, you've lost about 93-94% of your nitric oxide production by your 60s. So you can take a big dose of a supplement and not get anywhere near where you were as a kid.
Okay.
But it also depends. Are you on a medication like the
ED
drugs? Okay. Well, see, you probably do better with something like tadalafil. I'm getting a signal saying we need to take a break, but hold that thought tadalafil in your head. We'll come back in a minute and I'll explain what may be a better impact for you, okay?
Thank you.
All right. We'll take a quick break and we'll be back with more Leading Edge Medicine in just a moment. Here's that number to get through and into our call queue, 1-800-465-8770. We'll be right back.
Hands, touching hands, reaching out. Touching me, touching you. Sweet Caroline.
And we're back.
Yes, we are.
It's Leading Edge Medicine. Dr. Jerry Mixon here. And along with Dr. Jerry Mixon today, our guest doctor in the studio, Dr. Dan Nelson. Here's that number to call, 1-800-465-8770. That's just like Howard did. And Howard, we were continuing to talk with the doctors about tadalafil.
Right. Okay. Tadalafil is a drug that is normally connected with erectile disorders, and that's the number one reason it's prescribed in America. And it works by not letting you get rid of your nitric oxide. So
right.
Whatever
I've heard
nitric
you describe
oxide,
it quite a bit over the last few years.
Yeah. And so it keep you make nitric oxide and it interferes with the destruction. So your nitric oxide sticks around. If you use tadalafil along with one of the nitric oxide supplements, such as the Neo 40, then you kick out extra nitric oxide and you don't get rid of it as fast. And so you get a double effect. The problem with that, of course, is it can once more drop your blood pressure so low because you're dilating all those blood vessels, letting the blood flow through. Blood pressure goes down, and once more, you can fall down. I actually had that happen to me recently. And I was, you know, I take tadalafil because it cuts your risk of prostate cancer by 50%. And so I think every man over 40 should probably be on one of these we call them PDE5 inhibitors, because they improve blood flow to the brain, they improve blood flow to the muscles, they cut your risk of prostate cancer, and in women it slows the growth of breast cancers, even if they have one. So I say every man and every woman, and if it makes your sex life more robust on the side, well, that, as side effects go, I think that's great. Okay. So,
yeah, well, I asked my doctor if I could take that, and he said, well, I'd rather have you take Flomax. And I don't have any trouble with Flo or ED for that matter, but he didn't kind of want to listen to me.
Yeah, but see, Flomax does nothing for your, it's a smooth muscle relaxer, it's true, but it doesn't protect your prostate. And yeah, that's the biggest danger us old guys have got.
Yeah, okay. So if you do things to increase your nitric oxide, it seems to me, though, it doesn't stay in the system more than a few hours, correct?
That's right, yes. Except, again, the reason I like tadalafil as opposed to sildenafil, which sildenafil is the chemical name for Viagra, it lasts three or 4 hours. So to get an all-day result, you got to take it about three times a day. Sildenafil or the tadalafil lasts for 36 hours. And so a small dose every day over a course of 3 or 4 days builds up to a nice steady state and provides you with nitric oxide that sticks around all the time. And you always have lower and better blood flow, lower blood pressure with better blood flow.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the beet supplements, I'm thinking, even if I don't notice any help, since they're such dark red, they must be full of bioflavonoids and stuff about, right? Okay, good.
Yes, they certainly
okay,
are.
Well, thank you very much. You answered all my questions. Appreciate that.
All right. Take care, sir. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Howard. 10 minutes away from 9 o'clock, you're listening to Leading Edge Medicine, and we are going to pop onto a ferry and head to Bremerton. We have, no, we're not. We are staying in Seattle before we take that ferry. We have Robert on the line. Good morning, Robert. How can we help?
Good morning. Good morning. I have a couple of questions. Number one for the knee guy.
Okay.
I have problems with my knees. I've always had problems with my knees lately. And thinking of different things to do, but I'm just wondering about nerve ablation. Is there a danger to that? And it just seems to me like if you ablate it, you kill the nerves, that would be the best solution for removing pain. And are there any potential problems with that?
Right. So we do a nerve ablation, genicular nerve ablation for chronic knee pain. And these patients are often, you know, advanced arthritis situations. And maybe they're not a good candidate for a knee replacement or stem cell therapy. Sometimes we'll use when we do stem cell injections, we'll do that as an adjunct, the nerve ablations. And the ablation really is not like going to interfere with motor function. That's important. So you're still going to be able to walk normally. The downside of the ablation, you know, it's a risk. So anytime you break the skin barrier, bleeding, infection, nerve damage, those are extremely rare. The downside I would say is that these nerves will grow back over time. So you might get 6 months to a year, pretty good pain relief, maybe not 100%, but in some cases we're talking about patients taking them from being miserable to manageable with an RFA, radiofrequency ablation of the nerves. So it's a nice tool in the toolkit, but it's certainly not, and I, of course, not knowing any, you know, Robert, about you, I haven't seen your x-rays or anything like that, so it's hard for me to know what's appropriate. That certainly wouldn't be the first thing I'd think about when I see a patient with knee pain, but so is that how did that come up? Did you talk to somebody about that, or?
Well, I do take PRP injections. They work for about 3 months. And I'm looking for something that works a longer period of time. Just hoping it. So it just sounded to me like killing the nerves would definitely give you less pain. I don't think I have a major arthritis problem. One of my concerns is I was just recently diagnosed with a mild form of Crohn's disease, and I understand that also has effects upon joints. And I don't know how to determine whether or not my knees are more related to that or to something else. I don't know if that can be determined.
Robert, I'm sorry, I missed the first part. You're taking what for 3 months at a time?
PRP.
Oh, PRP. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I had mild Crohn's disease, and I don't know whether I can't be sure, and I don't know if there's a way to tell, you know, whether it's the Crohn's that is causing joint problems or something else.
Right. Well, and that's where I would refer you to our local rheumatologist, because there is a connection of arthropathies with Crohn's disease. That's about all I can tell you. That's definitely outside my scope
If he's getting good relief for 3 months from PRP, then I would at least consider the possibilities of the stem cells.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Because the PRP is a potent anti-inflammatory. There's 9 growth factors in those platelets. But if he takes the stem cells out of your bone or out of your fat and injects your own stem cells into that knee, the stem cells actually get working good after about 3 months. I mean, the PRP gives you short-term upfront relief, and then the stem cells are what actually kick out the medicinal factors to heal and repair what's going on in that knee to start with. So,
I mean, as Dr. Kaplan would say, he said, I wish I'd called them medicinal signaling cells instead of mesenchymal stem cells.
Yes.
Only getting 3 months from the PRP, to me, that's not very satisfactory. You know, if a patient of mine, I was doing PRP injections and they were only getting 3 months, I'd say, yeah, that's not great. What else can we do? The ablations, that certainly can help, but that's also not permanent. And also, you know, I'd really have to know, again, we're on the radio, I can't examine you, look at your x-rays or MRI and say, okay, well, what else is going on here? So that's, I would just say I don't like the fact that you're only getting 3 months from the PRP injections.
You know, I recall when Dr. Nelson did my left hip, and I had a I had some arthritic changes in my hip because I'd had an old fracture there and have an irregularly shaped
with a good story to go with that.
Yes, yes. Well, I damaged it doing something stupid on the ski slopes. But, you know, he injected the stem cells and PRP at the same time and then brought me back in about 6 weeks and did another PRP. And right. then over the course of about 6 months, my hip improved about 80%. He went back and did a second stem cell PRP series, and that was, what, 3 or 4 years ago now, and I have zero pain in that hip. I can do anything and everything I want. So I would suggest you come in and let Dr. Nelson take a look, do right. the studies he wants to do, and let him give you his best advice based on what he finds with your exam and your right. imaging studies.
Absolutely. And this brings up a good point, is that people ask me, well, I can give people an idea, what's the chance of success doing stem cell, PRP? I can give you a rough idea, you know, in knees, for example, probably 75-80% success rate. Then the other question is, how long is it going to last, right? So yeah. that's I don't know. Yeah. And because everybody's different. And Dr. Mixon pointed out, we did a repeat at some point after that. And that's why it's nice to have the big toolbox. I mean, we talked about RFA, radio frequency ablation. That's one thing we can add on. So we're not like going to sell everybody on stem cells to walk through the door because no. sometimes it's just not appropriate. We got other things that are maybe more appropriate and covered by insurance. Why not do that, go down that road? And the stem cell is the bright, shiny object in our tool chest. But, yep. I'm not going to recommend that unless I think it's really appropriate.
Okay, I have one ancillary question, and that is, I called in a few weeks back, and I think that Dr. Mixon said that he was going a little lighter on the red yeast rice. And my question is, I'm heavy on it, and I'm thinking of cutting it in half, because I'm just wondering whether, that is not can be problematic in certain areas. So was I correct in hearing Dr. Mixon say that you would cut yours in half? I take 2,400 yeah. mg a day.
Yeah, well... For me, I'm pretty sensitive, and so to the levostatin that's in the red yeast rice, and so I was getting side effects from it. I was getting a little mm-hmm. bit fuzzy headed. I was getting kind of wasn't able to perform physically as well as I wanted to. So I cut it mm-hmm. back, and that went away. So it was just a therapeutic trial.
Yeah, that's a question I have in relation to knee pain, too, because I understand that it could affect knee pain in some sense.
Yeah, although it tends to be more of a diffuse joint pain.
Right.
When you're getting the effect from the statin, it's usually kind of a total body. Everything just kind of aches and doesn't have the mobility and the strength and energy that you want to have.
And okay, well, thanks a lot. I appreciate you taking the time to answer the questions.
You're welcome, sir. You take care. Bye-bye. Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with more Leading Edge Medicine. We will talk with Bill from Bremerton. And if you have a question for the doctors, the phone lines are open at 1-800-465-8770. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay right there.